From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Senate Republicans are set to vote today on whether to start debate on health care reform. But exactly what they'd be debating, though, is still unclear. The Better Care Reconciliation Act, which would repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or the Obamacare Repeal Reconciliation Act, which would effectively just repeal the ACA, but not replace it. Even senators who are voting today don't yet know. Joining us now with more is Julie Rovner. She's chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you are one of the most seasoned healthcare reporters I know. I just want to get to this. Has this ever happened before in Washington?
Not that I have ever seen. And as I tweeted last night, I've covered every major healthcare bill since 1986. I have never seen anything even remotely close to this. The idea that the Senate wants to do a bill that could impact in a major way a sixth of the economy, and no one knows what that bill is going to be.
It's incredible when you think about it. They're going to take a vote on proceeding to debate over something they don't know what they're going to be debating on. So what then are the big questions still outstanding before the vote for the senators and for the rest of the country?
Well, the big question is still what can pass. It's looking increasingly like they may well be able to get the 51 votes that they need to start the debate. But it seems that almost everything that they're going to bring up doesn't have the 50 votes it would need to get out the other side. So now they're talking about this sort of what they're calling, you know, skinny repeal, which would be sort of the lowest common denominator that everybody can agree on. But there are technical reasons why that might be difficult as well. So they could start this debate and end up not being able to approve anything.
Okay, and what might some of those technical reasons be?
Well, some of them have to do with the process that they're using. It's called budget reconciliation. It is a budget process. And because it is a budget process, it can be fast-tracked, not have the lengthy debate that the Senate normally has. And it can pass with, as we've said, only 51 votes. The problem with that is they're very limited in what they can do. And one of the things that they have to do is meet the targets that were set out in the budget resolution, which were pretty small. But because the Senate committees didn't act, they're using the House bill, they'd have to save at least as much money as the House bill saved. That was about $120 billion over 10 years. And a very small bill might not reach that spending level or that savings level, and that would make it problematic. So it's really difficult. The other thing we saw is that there are rules about what can be included in this type of bill. They have to be directly affect the federal budget. There was a whole list that was put out by the Senate parliamentarian last week of things that likely couldn't be included, and those included a lot of things that were very important to a lot of Republicans, like defunding Planned Parenthood for a year.
Interesting. But given the mood in Washington right now and in the Senate, one wonders how strong those rules or how those rules may hold going forward. But just let me ask you, Senator John McCain, of course, came back from Arizona in time for this vote. And it's been, less than a week since he was diagnosed with an aggressive form of brain cancer. I mean, how significant is his return? And do we know at all how he's going to vote?
No, we don't know how he's going to vote. That's the most important thing. His office put out a statement that said he has returned to vote on the bill, and then he's going to give a statement, and then apparently he's going to have a press conference. But we don't know which way he's going to vote. He was not necessarily a yes. He said he was worried about what his governor thought of the bill. His governor had expressed serious concerns, a Republican governor in Arizona, about the Medicaid cuts in the bill. We haven't heard much from the governor, and we haven't heard much from Senator McCain. So he's not necessarily a slam dunk, but if he were to vote for it, which would be the expectation, then they could lose. Then they'd have to lose three votes in order for it to not succeed. I know these are triple negatives, but his being there, assuming he's going to vote for it, makes it easier for that vote to pass.
So who else then in the Senate will you be watching this afternoon?
Well, we're going to be watching some of the moderates. We're pretty sure Susan Collins from Maine is still a no, but Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Dean Heller from Nevada. Those are sort of the three that everybody is keeping a close eye on, and they have not said how they would vote. Also, Mike Lee, a conservative from Utah, isn't entirely happy with this. Rand Paul, who had been the strongest no, said he will vote, at least to start debate, because he's been promised that he would get a vote on his sort of repeal bill, which also probably won't have, certainly won't have 50 votes. That's one of the things that they're likely to take up that's likely then not to succeed.
We've got about 30 seconds here, Julie. President Trump has been tweeting today, including about health care, but has he been involved in any substantive way speaking to senators about health care?
Most senators say they've been talking to the vice president and the secretary of Health and Human Services and other you know, White House and administration officials, but not to the president directly. On the other hand, he has been using the bully pulpit of late, particularly yesterday, including in his speech to the Boy Scout Jamboree.
Right. Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, on a remarkable day in Washington. Julie, thank you.
You're most welcome.
So the House of Representatives has already passed its version of a bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, House Speaker Paul Ryan shepherding it through the legislature. But not all of his constituents back home in Wisconsin are happy with that. They also say Ryan hasn't held any open town hall meetings since the presidential election. As Marty Michelson from Here and Now contributor WUWM in Milwaukee reports, with his national poll numbers sinking, Ryan's critics believe it's a good time to topple him, too.
It's noon on a sunny Saturday, and several hundred people pack a town hall meeting in Racine, Wisconsin, a Democratic stronghold in Paul Ryan's district.
Hello, good to see you.
A community activist group invited the House Speaker to answer constituents' questions at the town hall, but as expected, he didn't show up. Instead, a Democratic congressman from a neighboring district steps up to the microphone. Carl Lassiter says he wants Ryan to face voters who are upset with him.
I think Paul Ryan is a slick politician who's afraid to talk to people who differ from his point of view. And that's one of the reasons why he's hiding out and going to just invitation-only meetings or meetings where people are friendly towards one another.
Another constituent is Mary Taturo, a yoga instructor. She thinks Ryan is out of touch with the people of his district.
I do not believe that Paul Ryan, my congressman, has any concerns for the middle class or the lower class, or for any of us, actually.
Taturo says she plans to campaign for Randy Bryce, an iron worker and Army veteran. Bryce announced in June that he will be running as a Democrat against Ryan in 2018.
I decided to run for office because not everybody's seated at the table, and it's time to make a bigger table. I'm the best person to represent this district because I'm a working person. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C.
Bryce's announcement video went viral and gained him some national press. He told MSNBC his number one campaign issue is health care, and it's personal. Bryce says his mother suffers from multiple sclerosis, and he has battled testicular cancer.
I have to worry about, you know, cancer coming back for me. I have to worry about my son going to play on a jungle gym. Do I have to worry about him getting hurt or just letting him be a kid? And it affects my mother, who obviously is the star of the video. And not shown in the video is my father, who has Alzheimer's. And I consider ourselves lucky because we have insurance. And it shouldn't be a matter of have and have nots. It's a basic right for everybody.
Paul Ryan spent much of the summer dealing with the now collapsed Republican health care bill. The speaker defends his decision to hold what he calls telephone town hall meetings, where constituents phone in their concerns. And he recently visited a couple of businesses in his district and took questions on a variety of topics with employees. Ryan says he prefers these types of private interactions to public town halls.
I'm finding lots of different ways of having a good civil dialogue with constituents. I don't want to have a situation where we just have a screaming fest, a shouting fest, where people are being bussed in from out of the district to get on TV because they're yelling at somebody. That does nobody any good.
While some constituents think Ryan is out of touch with the district, others think he's doing a great job. Mike Kenziera is having breakfast at Euros West, a diner in the Republican stronghold of Waukesha. He says he's voted for Ryan every time since he moved to the district a few years ago and plans to do so again in 2018.
I'm a conservative Republican at heart, and I like his views on a lot of constitutional things, especially the Second Amendment. I like his tax plans. And, you know, I'm real strong on getting Obamacare repealed and replaced.
Kenziera doesn't think Ryan will have any problem winning re-election, and the polls bear that out. A public policy polling survey this past spring saw Ryan's numbers plummet to an all-time low of 21% nationally after healthcare talks fell apart. But a survey by the same company of voters only in Ryan's district has him with a 43% approval rating. And says Lily Gorin, a political scientist at Carroll University, any Ryan opponent would have to overcome the speaker's formidable war chest. Recent campaign finance reports show Ryan has more than $9 million on hand.
I have a feeling it would take a lot of money, a lot of support from the National Democratic Party, as well as a real potential wave election.
Other candidates looking to topple the incumbent include Kathy Myers, a school board member from Ryan's hometown of Janesville. And Ryan could face a primary challenge from an old foe. Republican Paul Nealon has announced his intention to run against the House Speaker. It would be a rematch from 2016's Republican primary, in which Ryan beat Nealon by 68 points. For Here and Now, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
The Boy Scouts are in the news after President Trump gave a political speech last night at the Scouts Jamboree. We'll play some in a moment. You decide if it was too political. But we don't want it to overshadow news from the Girl Scouts, who are getting new cybersecurity badges. Now, for those of us who only had the opportunity to get, say, cooking and horseback riding badges, although we worked on earning them as if our very lives depended on it, new badges is thrilling news. And it's also part of a serious effort to get girls into a field that needs them. In today's View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders, let's talk scouting with the Girl Scouts' new CEO, Sylvia Acevedo, a former rocket scientist with NASA. Sylvia, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's a real pleasure to be here and talk about our brand new STEM and outdoor badges.
Well, and also from the perspective of a former scout yourself, correct?
Absolutely. You know, I got my start in Girl Scouting when I was a brownie, and it completely changed my life. And actually, one of the reasons I became an engineer and a rocket scientist is directly attributable to my Girl Scout experience. You know, my troop leader saw me looking at the stars one night during an outdoor adventure, and she taught me that there were constellations, and she encouraged me to earn my science badge. And later on, I took math and science at a time when girls like me weren't taking those math and science electives. And I had the confidence in that when people told me I couldn't be an engineer, that I could be an engineer. And I earned my science badge making Estes rocket kits. So it was such a great feeling and a thrill for me to get my job at NASA's Jet Propulsion Labs to be working as a rocket scientist.
First of all, let me give you an opportunity. For me, it's Mrs. Watson, Troop 389, Long Island, New York. Always will thank her. What's the name of your leader?
Oh, so I had two, Mrs. Beeman and Mrs. Provine in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
And this was particularly important to you, I understand, because your grandparents, I think, were immigrants from Mexico. And you had not felt assimilated into the community until Scouts.
Yeah, you know, all my grandparents were from Mexico. My dad was born in the U.S. My mom was born in Mexico. And yes, you know, I lived in a predominantly Spanish-speaking neighborhood and at first, and then we moved into a different neighborhood. But, you know, our household was at that time, we spoke Spanish at home. And so Girl Scouts really gave me the opportunity to understand a lot more about the world around me and in the U.S. And it wasn't just for me. It was also for my mom. My troop leaders really befriended my mother, helping her to, you know, support Girl Scouting, helping her learn English, and then also helping her earn her American citizenship. And I was so proud when I was flying up from a brownie to junior, my mom was also flying up and becoming an American citizen thanks to Girl Scouts.
Okay. So now you want to take what you've learned about what scouting can do and apply it to Scouts today. By the way, membership has stabilized after falling off for a while. So that's really great news for those of us who love scouting. But girls are expressing to you that they want to move into these other fields. Do I understand that that's what the thinking behind this new badge was? It came from the girls.
Well, you know, our STEM badges and our outdoor badges, yes, we always solicit a lot of input from girls. And we also want to have them not just be users of technology, but creators of technology as well. And so these badges are everything from like programming rockets to building model race cars to writing code to having outdoor adventures. These are things that girls want. And our badges are everything from daisies, which is kindergarten, all the way to high school in 12th grade.
And so how are you going to make it age appropriate? Like when it comes to cybersecurity, you know, what are the topics you're going to start with daisies and then move through?
So the first 9 of those are going to be for the younger ages, daisies, brownies. But you're right. It's things like, you know, how do you protect your identity online? How do you make sure you protect yourself from bullies? But then the year after that, we're going to have our badges for the older girls. And it's going to be, you know, coding, white hat, cybersecurity. You know, now more than ever, we need to have more girls join cybersecurity ranks. There is a yawning skills gap in that area, and we're stepping up. We almost see this as a patriotic duty to make sure that we have girls that have the interest, the courage, the confidence to be able to pursue those types of jobs.
Well, I'm looking at some of the stats that the industry, the cybersecurity industry, is facing a deficit of 3.5 million by 2021. This is a Cybersecurity Ventures has, you know, crunched the numbers. Currently, women are just 11% of that workforce. And so the aim is to close the gap on both sides with women. And Girl Scouts, I understand from other research, could be the perfect place to do that because it is all women. Talk about that, what research shows.
You know, research shows that girls are more likely to try an activity that is more stereotypically not for, you know, seen as something for them. If they're in an all-girl environment, they can collaborate, you know, they're not afraid of being criticized or they can try, they can experiment. She's willing to lead in an environment that normally in, you know, maybe outside of Girl Scouts, she doesn't have that opportunity.
Yeah, you're partnering with Palo Alto Networks, which is a cybersecurity firm, part of Silicon Valley. What feedback are you getting from them that you might not have known? Now, you might have known as a rocket scientist, but tell us more about the symbiosis there.
We're really excited about this opportunity because, you know, they need to have more trained experts in cybersecurity. And Girl Scouts, we have from our very beginning, we've always had an experience in creating the STEM pipeline. So if you think of many of the female astronauts, they were Girl Scouts. You know, many of the STEM technology leaders, they were Girl Scouts. Now what we're doing with Palo Alto Networks is we're expanding that pipeline. You know, our goal is to have over 5 million girls filling that STEM pipeline in the next few years.
I'm looking at Melanie Larson. She's the spokesperson for the Girl Scouts of Greater Los Angeles. She's quoted in the Los Angeles Times saying that it's not just about learning coding. It's about having work in these badges that helps girls if they're going to go into a field that's been traditionally male so that they can feel safe or they can find their voices. So there's, you know, accent on risk-taking, empathy. That's part of the badge as well.
Absolutely. You know, in Girl Scouting, yes, we look at that girl potential and we want to develop her potential and we want to teach her skills. But that's not where it ends. We also ask her to take action to improve your community and also being able to ask for support so that when they go into a working environment, you know, a lot of women don't often ask for help. But in Girl Scouts, you learn that it's okay to ask for guidance and support. And that's part of our model. And that's been that way since Juliet Gordon Lowe founded us over 100 years ago.
Sylvia Acevedo, CEO of the Girl Scouts. You know, this is our View from the Top segment. We've kind of kept it with this new development in Girl Scouting. But I want to ask you to comment on something that happened with the Boy Scouts. This is President Trump speaking before the Boy Scout Jamboree last night. I'm sure you're aware of it. And he took it in a very political way. And I just wonder how this is resonating in the scouting world. He talked about the election. Your thoughts about crossing a partisan line with scouting. Is Scouts partisan?
We are two completely different organizations. The Boy Scouts are a separate organization. We're a completely different organization. And we are focused every day on creating girls of courage, confidence, and character to make the world a better place. And we are totally dedicated to create the best leadership experience for girls in America in a nonpartisan way. That's our focus.
And that's your comment.
That's my call. Yeah. Thank you.
Sylvia Acevedo, CEO of the Girl Scouts. Thank you so much.
I thank you very much, and I'm not surprised you're a Girl Scout.
Back at you.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump's speech last night at the Boy Scout Jamboree in West Virginia was attended by 40,000 scouts from across the country, and it's raising eyebrows. Before the rally started, the scouting.org blog issued a warning. Please help us ensure that all scouts can enjoy this historical address by making sure that your troop members are respectful not only of the president, but of the wide variety of viewpoints held by scouts in the audience. Scouts were asked to avoid chants, which might cause unnecessary friction. But then President Trump himself launched into the very politics the young men were asked to avoid. He introduced cabinet members that had been scouts. And when the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Secretary Tom Price, came out, added a scathing critique of Obamacare.
And hopefully he's going to get the votes tomorrow to start our path toward killing this horrible thing known as Obamacare that's really hurting us. So.
After extended chants of USA, USA, President Trump continued to Secretary Price.
By the way, you're going to get the votes? He better get them. He better get them. Oh, he better. Otherwise, I'll say, Tom, you're fired. I'll get somebody.
The president also attacked the media, especially back on election night.
Do you remember that incredible night with the maps? And the Republicans are red and the Democrats are blue. And that map was so red, it was unbelievable, and they didn't know what to say.
He went on to say it was the Boy Scouts who helped him win, as if none could have been in Democratic families. He mentioned his opponent, Hillary Clinton, and chuckled during some boos, took a jab at his predecessor.
Did President Obama ever come to a jamboree?
In fact, President Obama addressed the 2010 National Jamboree by video and was a Boy Scout as a child. Now, some who were there said the president got a mix of cheers and boos from the boys, but social media exploded. Among the many comments on the Boy Scouts of America Facebook page, as a former scout, I am appalled that the jamboree was turned into a political rally tonight, unless the BSA condemns the president's conduct, which included bullying, name-calling, and swearing. I will know there's no place for my two sons in scouting. There was also support for the president. Here's one comment on Twitter. Liberals triggered bigly as Trump speaks the truth to 40,000 cheering scouts molding the future leaders. So, the president is the honorary president of the Boy Scouts of America, and a president can do what he wants. We'll post President Trump's speech last night, but would love to hear from you. Were you there? Did you have kids there? Your thoughts on politics and scouting are welcome at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen, with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions, and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
Israel has removed metal detectors from the holy site known to Jews as the Temple Mount and to Muslims as Haram al-Sharif. Muslim worshippers have been boycotting the site since the metal detectors were installed earlier this month, following the killing of two Israeli policemen near the temple on July 14th. For more, we're joined now by the BBC's Tom Bateman in Jerusalem. And Tom, Israel says it's replacing these metal detectors with other security measures. Do we know what those will be?
We don't know specifically. I mean, they released a statement overnight. This was the Israeli government's security cabinet. But what they would replace them with was a bit less clear. They said it would be, quote, advanced technologies, smart checks, they said. Now, I've been chatting to one government minister today who said that this would be security cameras that would be placed all around the old city of Jerusalem. Now, that's a much, much wider area than this very sensitive and holy compound is to be found. And she said it would be a bit like what they have in Mecca, where she said they have, you know, a vast number of security cameras, but things are a bit less conspicuous and, you know, it allows the authorities to check up perhaps on people they think might be suspicious. The key point being, I think these would be less obtrusive and less obvious than the metal detectors that caused the problems and caused the controversy over the last 10 days or so.
Now, as we mentioned, the metal detectors were first installed following the killing of Israeli policemen. I'm wondering, are there fears, are there concerns that this latest development could lead to continued or even more violence?
Well, I think that's a really important point, you know, because what the Israeli government keeps pointing out is they feel that that starting point to this crisis has been lost in all of the debate around it. And of course, the violent clashes that then followed, because It was nearly a fortnight ago now that two Israeli police officers, as you say, were shot dead on the compound. They were attacked by three Arab Israeli men. And the police said the guns, the weapons were smuggled in to the site itself. Now, some Palestinians have shown some skepticism about that claim. Nevertheless, the police have put out security footage they say proves that point. And so the Israeli government said initially these were an absolutely crucial security measure to have these metal detectors, that it was only about security. It wasn't about changing what is known as the status quo, the long-held agreement about the way that site is managed. Now, there was a lot of international pressure. Jason Greenblatt, the White House's envoy to the region, was sent out yesterday. He's been talking to some of the key players. The UN had said it was really worried about all of this. And so we had the statement overnight. Now, what's happened over the last few hours is the Islamic Authority that manages that site on a day-to-day basis has said, well, it wants to wait and see exactly what the security arrangements are. And in the meantime, the boycott by Palestinian worshippers of the mosque continues. And again, this lunchtime, there were prayers out in the street outside.
Well, I mean, given the controversial nature of the site, I mean, is there any long-term solution just regarding this site that could satisfy both sides?
This was always much more than about just these metal detectors. It was really about what the Palestinians see as the struggle for Jerusalem, what Israel sees as trying to maintain security in the whole city. And so I think, you know, because it was about this site, which in the past has had the potential to spark very dangerous and violent conflicts, people were getting very concerned about where this might go. There is some hope now, I think, that things may have calmed, but that remains to be seen as we await the Palestinian and the Muslim religious leaders' response to all of this.
Tom Bateman is the BBC's correspondent in Jerusalem. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The new film Maudie is based on the true story of Nova Scotia folk artist Maud Lewis. Despite hands and feet gnarled by crippling juvenile arthritis coupled with poverty, she painted and won fame in the mid-1900s. The film Maudie tells of the unlikely love story between Maud and the almost nonverbal fisherman and former orphan Everett, which blooms in a tiny house they share, and Maud transforms, painting the walls, windows, everything. Maud, played by Sally Hawkins, meets Everett, played by Ethan Hawke, through his ad for Housemaid.
I'm Maud. Dowley.
Dowley?
Yeah, that's right. It was got your ad at the store. One you posted looking for a housemaid.
Oh,
yeah. Well, I'm answering it.
Looking for a woman.
Well, what do you think I am?
Initially, Everett is cruel, even physically and emotionally brutal to Maud, and Everett's language is as spare as the landscape. There's a recurring wide shot across a huge field, the ocean beyond, Everett in the far distance pushing his fish cart across the field, Maud trudging far behind. Then later she walks next to him. Finally, same wide shot, she's in the cart. And Ethan Hawke joins us now. Ethan, welcome back to Here and Now.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And I want to talk to you about Everett. But before that, can we talk to you about Sally Hawkins' Maud? Her hands twisted and tortured by this arthritis. You're working with another actor who was lost in the role.
I felt really blessed. We were out in the middle of nowhere, away from anybody we knew and any friends. And Aisling Walsh, our director, built this little house. And we had just these characters, and Sally's imagination is so powerful and so mystical and so fun to be involved in that it has its own gravitational pull. It's really exciting to be a part of.
Yeah.
Aisling and Sally approached me to be in this movie with them. I think they'd heard that I had a place out in Nova Scotia, so they thought that I might have an interest in these people, and they were right. And a lot, you mentioned in your introduction, a lot of our job was about figuring out how little we could say. You know, that when you said as quiet as the landscape or something, you said, and I thought, yeah, that's right. Exactly. We were really trying to emulate a Maud Lewis painting.
Let's hear a little more of you. NPR critic Bob Mandela says you're almost unrecognizable in Maudie. We are hearing that you are a very articulate fellow. We've talked to you before. Let's listen to a scene later in the film. This is after, you know, your character's been almost brutal to Maud. with her disabilities, and there's this tenderness that develops. And here we hear your character, Everett, trying to express his feelings.
I don't want you to leave me.
Why would I do that?
Because you can do much better than me.
Ethan Hawke, tell us more about what you put into Everett, what you brought to Everett. You see, I didn't know you had a house in that region. Who, you know, what were you observing in the people? What were you trying to say?
I don't know. That landscape in that area of the world really speaks to me. And, you know, that scene that you just played, where the movie is at that point, I find really interesting, which is that he spent all this time seeing her in service to him. And actually falling in love with her and starting to respect her. But then as the rest of the world falls in love with her and he's worried he's going to lose her, what's revealed is he's placed himself in the same box that he put her in, which is he doesn't think he has any value. Mm. What was so fun about getting to do this scene work with Sally, you know, the movie spans over a couple decades, is we got to explore how power dynamics in a long-term couple are constantly shifting. In one situation, one person is empowered and another person is submissive, and how that can keep spinning around and how it can actually, I don't know, I find real people's relationships are so much messier and stranger and weirder than we are used to seeing. And Maude and Everett, they lived together for 30 years in this tiny 12 by 12 house. And I think when I said that I was trying to act a painting, there's something about her paintings, the ones that I love the best. You know, sometimes she'll just paint two oxen or two deer, just two animals, a masculine and feminine, just staring right at the lens or looking away from the lens. You know what I mean? That looking. And somehow in these pictures, she has all of humanity, all of life, this masculine, feminine energy mixed together. And I don't know. I didn't answer your question. Your question was about Nova Scotia, and I drifted. It's ungentrified, you know. It's wild. It's raw, and it's unpretentious. And I started going out there. I was probably in my early 30s. I had my first just kind of depression, and I wanted to escape. And I'd been out there. And I found there's something really healing. The horizon is always there. The place is wild. And you feel yourself. You can almost feel the earth turning, you know. And all of a sudden, the melodramas of the life of an actor get placed in a perspective that is very helpful for me. And I've fallen in love with some people out there. And so when I read this script, for me, my life as an actor is always about pushing your boundaries, but pushing them in ways that you know that you can succeed. And I know, and despite all his flaws, I had real genuine love for Everett, and I really wanted to do that portrait.
But listen, what about the real Everett Lewis? The New York Times Review points out that some biographical accounts portray him as a far worse man than even at moments he is through your portrayal. Did you read those accounts? Did you, you know, you're not the one writing the script, but did you
take responsibility for it? I mean, I've read some critics talk about how he's actually much nicer, and some said he was much meaner. I read it all, and my take was that he was a tough person.
Yeah.
We're talking about a period where one of the times I strike Maudie, or I don't, you know, Everett strikes Maudie, he does it in front of someone else, and they don't even respond negatively. As much as we all don't like to look at it, there has been a tremendous amount of abuse to women throughout history. And what I think is brave and interesting about the movie is to try to look at it and also to not just assume that people also can't love inside something very, very complicated. But I don't really worry too much. The real Everett Lewis exists, and his family exists, and we're just making art of that legend, you know?
You and Sally had a chance to see the real house, which has been preserved in the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia. I mean, were you stunned at how small it was, and these two people, strangers at first, live together in it?
It's really an incredible story. When you think about a guy hiring a live-in maid for his 12-by-12 cabin, it really is hysterical. And then imagine, it's her masterpiece, you know. Over the years that she lived here, she painted fairies and squirrels and ivy growing from the floor to the stove to the teacup. And it's exquisite. And if you go see it, it's all faded and then new layers. You feel the forest of her imagination in this room. It's really, really powerful. And I felt lucky because I was so proud of our production designer. I mean, they got it so right. I mean, when I feel like I lived in that house for a couple months.
Mm-hmm. Look, we've talked to you before. You always do something interesting. You've got the before films, before sunrise, before sunset, before midnight, sort of a series. Boyhood, filmed over so many years. You directed Seymour, An Introduction, the wonderful documentary about a legendary New York piano teacher. We spoke with him. You've published the graphic novel Inda, the children's book Rules for a Night. You co-wrote and directed the film Blaze, about country western musician Blaze Foley. You know, you're just poking around a lot. What's something that's an itch you want to scratch right now? What are you thinking? Let me do that.
You know, I kind of feel like a cat. I don't think like that. I just am trying to stay alive. You know, I did my first movie when I was 13, and I love doing this. I probably would like to, you know, I can imagine the second half of my life having more directing involved in it. I've loved that, the theater and movies that I've directed. So I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, we will be waiting to see what it is. Ethan Hawke, who co-stars in the new film Maudie. Ethan, thank you.
Well, thank you.
House Republicans are calling on tech and telecom leaders to help settle the debate over net neutrality. They've asked the heads of Facebook, Google, AT&T, and Comcast to appear before Congress as the Trump administration appears ready to scrap the Obama-era regulations which prevent internet service providers from selectively blocking or slowing down web traffic. Meanwhile, another major telecom company, Verizon Wireless, is being accused of violating net neutrality rules by capping the speeds at which it allowed customers to stream Netflix. So to help us navigate this weedy world of net neutrality rules is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of policy and politics for Recode. Tony, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Well, first of all, this is one of those policy questions which actually has an impact on just about every American. So let's get a baseline here. Remind us of the current net neutrality rules and what they say about ISP speed.
Yeah, it's pretty in the weeds. But net neutrality is this idea that all internet providers, companies like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, have to treat all web traffic equally. That means they can't slow down your Netflix, they can't slow down your YouTube and prioritize their services over another, and they can't block you outright from viewing some of that web content. This has gone back and forth for a long time in Washington, but the Obama administration in 2015 put in place really strong rules that treat internet providers much like old school telephone companies. They're essentially utilities, but the Trump administration in recent months has set about undoing those rules because it believes that they're too heavy-handed and they have great support among the telecom industry, which has long sought to avoid much net neutrality regulation from Washington.
Mm, and perhaps less support among content providers. But before we go any further, we should note that NPR has filed comments with the FCC in opposition to deregulation of net neutrality rules. But as you mentioned, Tony, it does seem certain that Ajit Pai, the head of the FCC under President Donald Trump, is seeking to abandon them. But, you know, you mentioned because he says that they're heavy-handed, but why? What does he say is so heavy-handed about these rules?
Yeah, it's important to remember that Republicans control all of Washington, and they truly have the votes and the power to do what they want to do here, which is to overturn the government's existing net neutrality rules. And really, it comes down to legal distinctions. Republicans and FCC Chairman Ajit Pai just do not believe that internet providers should be treated like telephone companies, that they shouldn't be regulated like utilities. Now, what Pai chooses to put in place is the subject of much debate. There's still a long comment process and debate to happen at the FCC, and Congress is starting to look at whether it should get involved here. But at the moment, the one thing that we know for sure is that the current net neutrality rules on the books are about as good as dead.
I see. Okay, so let's talk about this alternative track that Congress is taking? Because, as we mentioned, House Republicans are looking at the issues separately from the FCC. They're calling on tech and telecom leaders to weigh in. So tell us more about these efforts.
Yeah, there's been some consideration on Capitol Hill as to whether Congress should maybe get involved here. This issue has ping-ponged back and forth between the FCC and federal courts. It's like every time the agency did something, when it was under Democratic leadership, there'd be a telecom company right there ready to sue, and they generally prevailed every time they tried to challenge the government. So Congress is beginning to ask the question as to whether it should write a lasting law. And the big news today was at the House Energy and Commerce Committee, a very powerful panel that oversees tech and telecom issues, has asked the chief executives of top tech and telecom companies to show up at a hearing scheduled for September 7th. Mm-hmm. And the companies that have been invited include the likes of Facebook, Google, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, all of these big players. So it'll be interesting to see if, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and others who have been very vocal in their support for net neutrality actually agree to come to a hearing in Washington, D.C. in September to start to talk through some of these issues.
So, I mean, do you think that this is actually a possible way out of this endless back and forth that we've been having over net neutrality? I mean, Congress could ostensibly come up with a new set of rules suitable for the 21st century.
Yeah, I hate to be the constant cynic here, but no, I truly don't think that Congress has the solution to all of this. There's a lot of talk about the principle of net neutrality, the idea of internet openness, but really when you get down to the nitty-gritty, you know, what companies can and can't do, whether they can charge for the delivery of YouTube or Netflix videos faster, depending on what people pay. These sorts of specifics are the areas in which this debate has broken down for a long time, and tech and telecom companies and Democrats and Republicans simply can't agree. You know, you add to that the fact that the Trump administration is no fan of net neutrality, and you really do see a world in which Congress can't come to the table on an issue that's perplexed lawmakers for a long time. But, you know, they certainly say they're going to try, but we'll see if they can actually put together some legislation. But at the moment, there's a reason that there's a lot of talk about the ideas, but no, you know, hardcore specifics. It's because there aren't specifics and we're still fighting over them.
Tony, I'm trying to come up with reason to fight back your cynicism and I'm failing here. But what we should mention, that one thing that it goes unmentioned sometimes is that net neutrality rules apply to wired broadband, but mobile carriers can limit speed on purpose, right? Just got a couple seconds.
Yeah. Wireless providers generally have more leeway here to manage their networks, which is why we constantly see these issues about whether companies like Verizon can or can't do that sort of thing when it comes to streaming video.
Tony Rahm is senior editor of Policy and Politics for Recode. Tony, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.